This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, we got some housing, we got some foreign currency reserves, and we got a trip to the grocery store. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 19th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The big picture theme of the American economy this week, well, the first part of it anyway, is housing. We told you about home builders yesterday. Their confidence is down. Home sales are tomorrow. Today, it's all permits and starts. The number of permits issued for new construction down just a teensy bit. May to June, actual new construction starts, that is, homes actually starting to be built, down about 2%, actually. And there have been lots of signs of late that housing is cooling down. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports to get us going, cooling still does not mean affordable.
It's rough out there right now if you want to buy a house, especially for the first time.
It's the most unaffordable it's ever been.
David Dworkin at the National Housing Conference says that's because home prices are at record highs and mortgage rates are much higher now than they were 6 months ago.
Last year, in order to buy a $200,000 house, required an income of $60,000 a year. That same home today costs $330,000 and requires nearly $100,000 income.
And pretty much no one has gotten that kind of raise. There are also just fewer homes being built these days, Dworkin says, especially in that price range.
We've also seen since the beginning of the pandemic a huge decrease in the number of new homes being built that are less than $300,000.
Construction of all new homes fell way off more than a decade ago during the Great Recession, and we've never made up that deficit.
And we are now literally paying the price.
Buzz Roberts is with the National Association of Affordable Housing Lenders.
This is really hurting people very broadly.
Both buyers and renters, he says. About half of Americans now say housing affordability in their community is a major problem, according to Pew Research.
All housing is on a continuum.
Diane Yentel at the National Low Income Housing Coalition says when it becomes too expensive for people to buy, they rent for longer, which increases competition and drives up rents for everyone.
On its best day, the housing market is like a game of musical chairs. And when the music stops, it's always the people with the lowest incomes or no income left standing.
These days, Yentel says, that's happening to a growing number of people. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, everything's fine. Seriously, move along. Nothing to see here. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here is a just slightly wonky story that we're thinking might help illuminate some bigger issues in this global economy we all call home. Shout out to CNBC for picking up on this, by the way. There was a report out yesterday from the Treasury Department that showed China now holds a relatively meager $980 billion worth of U.S. government debt. It's the first time in a dozen years that Beijing has held less than $1 trillion in Treasury bonds. And it slides Beijing to the number two slot of foreign holders of U.S. debt behind Japan. Marketplace's Lily Jamali's on that one.
China's economy has slowed considerably in recent months.
You've had entire sectors of the economy effectively grind to a halt.
Now, says Gennady Goldberg of TD Securities, China is shedding U.S. treasuries to defend its own currency, the yuan, which has lost value as the dollar has gotten stronger.
What China wants to do is actually manage some of the pace of that depreciation. One of the ways that they do it is by selling the dollars and buying yuan.
Goldberg says the retreat of one of the largest buyers of U.S. treasuries could bolster the Federal Reserve's efforts to push interest rates higher to cool the economy. But it might also lead to tighter financial conditions than Fed policymakers want. Moving away from the dollar isn't easy, though.
The fundamental issue is, what do you do with $1 trillion? There are just not a lot of markets into which you can safely put $1 trillion.
That's David Dollar of the Brookings Institution's China Center. He says a big reason for China's shift comes down to politics.
They're unhappy with the way the U.S. keeps using financial sanctions around the world,
such as the exclusion of many Russian banks from the SWIFT international payment system shortly after the nation's invasion of Ukraine, says Thomas Hogan of the American Institute for Economic Research.
That was a major wake-up call for China and other nations that might not be aligned with the United States and Europe politically. They realized that the SWIFT system could be used as a political weapon to harm them economically.
Hogan expects the move away from U.S. debt will be slow and steady. After all, China won't want to harm the sizable investment it still has. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Hey, don't look now, but the completely kludged up global supply chain might be getting just a tad bit less kludged. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says things have been easing up. The Drewry World Container Index, it tracks shipping container prices, that's been falling. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to check in with some small businesses to hear what they have been seeing. And what he heard was, yeah, not exactly.
It's been a busy summer at Palmetto Tile Distributors, a supplier and importer based in South Carolina. Catherine Reynolds is a designer with the company. She says that's because a lot of people have been remodeling their homes.
You know, housing prices all over the country are through the roof. So a lot of people instead are just investing back into the property that they already own and making it the way they want.
But the tile people want often just hasn't been available. Reynolds manages the company's imports, which come mostly from Europe. She says shipments are still moving slowly through the ports of Savannah and Charleston. They're racking up storage fees, and shipping containers are still expensive.
We're right about the $20,000 mark for a container, which I used to be able to import for $7,000.
Shipments from her domestic manufacturers aren't much better. They're adding fuel surcharges and having problems sourcing materials. Plus, there's a shortage of truck drivers. We've been hearing about all of those problems for a while. And Reynolds says she's not expecting any of them to let up for a while.
I don't see us having any improvements well into next year, if then even, unfortunately. I wish it was different because it would make my job a lot less stressful.
Things haven't been much better for equipment supplier TMB Baking in San Francisco. It imports a lot of equipment from Italy, but the way it usually does that, shipping it through the Panama Canal and up to the Port of Oakland, has been taking way too long.
Most recently, it's taken over 3 months to get equipment to us.
That's Greg Warwick, TMB Baking CEO.
And that was about a 28-day quoted time frame pre-pandemic.
He says he has to bring that time frame down because there's a big baking equipment trade show in Las Vegas in September, the first one since the pandemic started.
We do have customers coming throughout the United States to visit TMB Baking and see our equipment. So it's critical that we get that equipment there to be able to show it to them.
So a couple months ago, Warwick tried a new strategy, shipping equipment to the East Coast and then moving it to the Bay Area by rail.
It will cut definitely at least a month off of that timing to get it here.
Farther south, outside Los Angeles, it's been getting a little easier for Hawaii Supermarket to import products. Chris Duong is the general manager.
I'm hearing from suppliers that their shipments are coming in more regularly now.
That would normally be welcome news, given that throughout the pandemic, Duong has been trying to make sure his store has enough products available. But lately, he says demand for the grocery items he sells has been falling.
Just because prices have gone up so much for the same items, we're selling less of them.
As a result, Duong says he's getting more cautious about importing too much and building up too much inventory.
Because we're not really sure of what's going on with the economy and how much demand there's going to be for the second half of the year and going into, you know, next year.
All of which means he's not as worried about how congested his supply chains are. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
One of the many things that's been happening since the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade last month is that people's relationships with their employers are treading some new ground. We've told you how a whole lot of companies, Amazon and Disney, Citigroup too, have all announced new employee health care benefits to pay travel expenses for workers who have to go out of state to get abortion care. And that new reality is raising a whole lot of questions about privacy and trust and stigmas around the kinds of care that people need. Maybe the closest comparison is getting mental health care through a company program. That's actually pretty common, as is the reluctance to talk about it. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has our story.
When Catherine started a new job as a manager of a warehouse in mid-2020, like a lot of people, she was feeling anxious. She doesn't want to use her full name because this topic is sensitive and her job is on the line. Her company sent out information about its employee assistance program, a standard benefit that usually includes access to mental health care. But she had concerns.
Starting out new, to share that side in terms of like mental health struggles felt extremely vulnerable. Are you going to be met with compassionate support, or are you going to be met with kind of a mental post-it note in their file on you?
These benefits are usually administered through an outside company, which is supposed to keep names and details private.
You believe it at its face, but I wasn't wanting to like dip my toe in the water enough at a time of pain or crisis. That wasn't when I was wanting to find out if it was legitimate or truly confidential.
Patrick Burnett sees this response a lot. He's the chief talent officer for Stafford County Public Schools in Virginia.
A lot of times people hear, oh, have you considered calling the employee assistance program? And, you know, as with any other mental health issue, there's a stigma attached to, what are you saying? I'm crazy. That people don't want to actively engage in the services.
He says these concerns are hard to overcome, even though Burnett has gone full court press to spread awareness of mental health benefits in onboarding, staff meetings, emails, and with a team of what the district calls wellness ambassadors.
You realize that this is the type of thing where people are going to be the pathway. I talk about my own mental health issues because I'm just like, hey, I'm trying to put myself out there to say, this is okay.
That kind of top-down signaling is important to create a culture of safety, says Julie Fabzik-Swartz, the CEO of the Employee Assistance Professionals Association.
When a CEO embraces mental health and says, I use this when I need it, I'm going to my therapist, not just I'm going to the doctors. And we've seen much better usage of EAP rates.
She says the share of employees using these benefits has always been on the low side. But during the pandemic, uptake jumped by more than 25%. Brian Kropp, head of HR research at Gartner, says the more public shared trauma of the last 2.5 years has created opportunities for some companies to promote their mental health resources.
What they've actually done is created moments across the year to reinforce the importance of that.
Like periodically shutting down work for a day to give employees time to take care of themselves, or acknowledging painful current events and giving employees ways to connect.
Just creating this culture of understanding where managers are completely accepting when their employee says, I have a personal health situation.
But there are still some big taboos, like mental health issues around addiction, says Paula Allen, who leads research at LifeWorks, an HR service firm focused on employee wellness.
People who might talk about their depression might not talk about their drinking. They're more worried about getting fired. They're more worried about people thinking it's, you know, just a behavior that they can snap out of if they had the moral strength.
Substance use increased significantly during the pandemic, according to the CDC. And a survey from the American Psychological Association found 1 in 4 adults increased drinking to cope with stress. But Allen says that's not getting enough attention.
That's why I think it's important for employers to sort of start speaking about substance use disorder in a very obvious way. Make sure that the mental health resources are front and center.
Treatment for substance use accounted for just 3% of all employee assistance program services sought in 2020. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's like, okay, I don't have time for this. Let me just grab something and go.
We take your grocery shopping with us, as promised. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, here you go. Dow Industrial is up 754 points today, 2.4%, 31,827. The NASDAQ up 353, that's 3.1%, 11,713. The S&P 500 up 105, that is 2.75%. I was going to say 2.75%, but you know, whatever. 39.36 there. Chip makers moved higher as the Senate prepared to vote on legislation that would make $52 billion in government subsidies available to them. Micron Technologies grew 3.2%. Intel improved 3.9%. Today, let's do a little oil and gas, shall we? Halliburton gushed up 2.1%. ExxonMobil up 2.5%. Occidental 4.6% there. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note 3.02%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just when we were all getting used to relatively cheaper oil prices, I'm obliged to point out here that West Texas Intermediate's back over $100 a barrel right now, 104 and change today. Gas is still going down, yes, but watch this space, as they say. But that is mere prologue to this next piece. A new report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says Texas oil and gas jobs might not get back to where they were in the before times, like ever. And it says that oil and gas just ain't the job creators that many think they are. Well, as it happens, Marketplace's Andy Euler is just back from a couple of days at the heart of Texas oil and gas employment, the Permian Basin, where industry executives were telling him a different tale.
Between September 2019 and September 2020, when COVID hit, oil and gas extraction and affiliated industries in Texas shed about 20% of their workforce. And while there's been a hiring uptick over the past few months,
we're only about halfway there as far as the recovery goes, and it looks like we're starting to plateau.
Trey Cowan wrote the report for the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He says there's a number of reasons for the slow pace of hiring. Operators say they can't find people who are, for instance, healthy enough to work on a rig and can pass a drug test. Industry trade group Energy Workforce and Technology Council blames anti-fossil fuel rhetoric. CEO Leslie Beyer emailed, quote, "continued vilification of the industry has a negative impact on recruiting, especially with younger workers," unquote. But it can actually be efficiency that's leading to fewer jobs in places like the Permian Basin. Hugh Daigle teaches petroleum engineering at the University of Texas at Austin.
They're getting more oil out of the ground with fewer people having to work for it.
But some say hiring fewer workers doesn't mean that the industry is done. Michelle Michaud-Foss is an energy studies fellow at Rice University in Houston.
In terms of its spending and its purchases, it is still huge. But the labor-capital ratio is shifting.
But Trey Cowan at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says the tried-and-true narrative that oil and gas will continue to be a driving force for employment in Texas is growing old.
The idea of creating policy around the oil and gas industry being a job creator is kind of a foolish way of looking at it.
He says oil and gas jobs follow the same boom and bust cycles the industry's been dealing with for decades. And everyone in the energy industry is trying to transition away from that. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Come with me now down into the data tables of the most recent report on the Consumer Price Index. 9.1% in June. That's overall year on year. We got that news last week, as you know. But it can be helpful, we believe, in moderation, to dig a little bit into the various component parts of those high-profile government reports. So, to data table number one we go, Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers, U.S. city average by expenditure category, June 2022. And right there on line two of the expenditure category, you find food. And just below that, food at home, the price index of which went up 12.2% in June from a year ago. A lot of people are cutting back on their spending. We've talked about that. But groceries are a tough one, right? You got to eat. And trying to keep costs down at the grocery store can be tricky, thanks to how those stores are designed. And also, oh, by the way, human nature. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra takes us along on one of her grocery runs in New York City.
This isn't going to be a huge shopping trip. I usually go a few times a week. Plus, I'm doing this on foot. The first thing on my list is an avocado. They're right near the entrance. Bam. Done. Got one. Next up, lemons. Got them. Cucumber, peaches, ginger, then watermelon. Where is the watermelon? I start doing circles around the produce section. And find the pine nuts, which I also need.
These don't even have a price on them.
Eh, into the cart. I turn right, and the watermelon is tucked away in a fridge in the corner.
Oh, excuse me.
Now, I don't need a whole watermelon. So, there's the chopped kind for $3.99 a pound. And then there's sliced with the rinds on for $1.99 a pound. I'm trying to figure out which is the better deal. And, you know, people need to get by with their carts. So the anxiety starts creeping in. Like, maybe I need to get out of the way. Maybe this one. I pick the sliced ones. Anxiety is common for grocery shoppers, apparently.
And it forces you to make a decision very fast, right?
Magdala Adeleke is a certified financial therapist.
It's like, okay, I don't have time for this. Let me just grab something and go.
Which means you spend less time analyzing the price. Now, I'm vibing with this music, singing it in my head, like, leave me breathless, go on. Remember this band, The Coors? They were big in the early 2000s. Aaron Ahuvia teaches consumer behavior at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. He says supermarkets choose their music carefully.
Oftentimes they'll play music that's a little bit older because it brings up these nostalgic feelings, and that is a positive experience for a lot of people.
And if you're in a good mood, maybe you'll buy more. I pick up some smoked salmon and spend a while trying to figure out which maple syrup to buy. And then I head to the spice aisle for vanilla extract and cinnamon. I grab the store brand, which is only 99 cents. Katrin Helens teaches marketing at the University of North Carolina, and she says grocery stores often steer you toward their brands because the store makes a higher profit on them.
But those products typically also have a lower price point, which may also be good for the consumer.
It's hard to know when a discount is actually good for you, though. Like Aaron Ahuvia from the University of Michigan says when something's on sale, that can trigger fear in shoppers.
And by this, I specifically mean a fear that you're going to lose out, that this is a rare opportunity.
And that fear can make you buy stuff you don't even want. What I do want is chicken thighs. So I grab some of those and then turn into the milk and cheese aisle on the far end of the store. I can't leave without almond milk. Katrin Helens says the location is intentional. The stuff you need, it's always in the back.
Why is that? Because it makes you sort of go through the entire store.
I'm approaching the finish line, almost at the register. And oh my God, it's a wall of ice cream. Cartons of cookies and cream, brownie cheesecake, chocolate pretzel swirl. Helen says retailers are always trying to create impulse moments.
And especially in supermarket context, the margins are so thin.
And Magdala Adeleke, the financial therapist, says these impulse buys, they get to that part of our psyche that's like, you know, it's been a tough day.
It's like, you want to feel worthy. If I, you know, indulge in this item, I work so hard, I am worth it, right?
But I keep going around the corner. And how helpful. The toilet paper and paper towels have been strategically placed at the end of an aisle right before the register. Helen says supermarkets don't necessarily want you to overspend because then you might not come back.
But they really want to make sure that whatever you want to spend on groceries, that you do it at their store.
At the register, I find out the pine nuts are $4.99 for a teeny little packet.
Okay, I'm going to leave them.
Without the pine nuts, it's $51.37. A little more than usual, thanks to a few items I don't get every time. Looking at you, maple syrup. I lug my bags home, exhausted. I'm Mary El Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Hey, pop quiz. When is losing 970,000 streaming video subscribers a good thing? It's a good thing when you're Netflix and you'd been whispering to people that you figured you were going to lose 2 million subscribers in this quarter, which they said today, 970,000. That's a good thing. Net income, a cool $1.4 billion. They do expect, Netflix does, to return to subscriber growth next quarter. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, though also Netflix related, and it's a total to which several members of my household contributed. In its earnings announcement this afternoon, the company said people watched a combined 1.3 billion hours of season 4 of Stranger Things in the first 4 weeks it was out. 1.3 billion hours. That's a lot of hours. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.